Well, what we've done up to this point is we've offered a series of arguments, obviously, for God's existence. And we've answered nearly all, if not absolutely all, of the standard objections to each one of these arguments. We looked at the Thomistic argument. We actually spent, I think, 14 hours just on that one argument alone, going through objections. Another 7 hours on the Kalam argument, and then multiple hours on the various design arguments. The exception to what I just said is we didn't really look at a whole lot of criticisms or pushback from some of those anthropological arguments that I gave. I'm fairly confident that we can answer all of them, but I've decided to go ahead and just offer those to you as sort of a potpourri of arguments based on certain features in human nature, which points us to God, as God is conceived in the classical tradition. So the question now becomes, well, what do you do now? In a sense, we've said all we can say. I could go and refine each of these arguments and try to dig up yet more objections and do the back and forth thing, but I personally never believe in offering anyone, commending an argument to anyone that I myself don't agree with. And I can at least just say, having looked at the objections to these arguments, some in more details than others, I'm just confident that the arguments are sound and that we have therefore proven God's existence. But of course, there is one more move that atheists and agnostics can make to try to stop us from proceeding. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to move to the next step. And there are some stumbling blocks that naturalistic thinkers have thrown at us that would stop the whole flow of the argument. And basically, the bottom line is this. The bottom line argument would be, at this point in the discussion, assuming that we have adequately answered all of the objections to the various premises of our arguments and so forth, the only thing left for them to do is to attack the conclusion. And in so attacking the conclusion, you have thereby nullified all of the arguments, even if you yourself don't know how to answer the premises. If the conclusion is impossible, then we have not proven God's existence. If the conclusion can't be true, then no matter how rational those arguments sound, then there's no way that we've proven God's existence. And so that is really the MO of the agnostic and atheistic community at this point. Go after the conclusion, show that it can't be true, and then, of course, we're able to sit back and say, well, your arguments are unsound even if I can't locate specifically how they're unsound. Remember the old dictum from
Sherlock? Using like logic where you just start with a false conclusion that can't be true and then go back and try to use the same argument?
I'm not sure if I understand what you're getting at.
If you're saying that the conclusion can't be true, then it breaks down the argument. So, I mean, did they sort of backpedal into that where they started with a conclusion that they knew could not be true? And then...
Well, maybe I'm answering your question when I say this. As Sherlock Holmes said, once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, has to be true. And therefore, I backpedal back to the argument, and I offer whatever explanation of the phenomena presents itself. It has to be anything other than God. Why? Because your God is impossible. There's no way that your God can exist. Or there's no way that you can know that God exists. Either kind of argument works. In principle, we know that you cannot know that God. And since we know that you cannot know that God, we know that your arguments, all of them, are unsound, or in the case of the more scientifically based arguments we looked at, they are inductively weak. Does that answer your concern or consideration? Okay. So what we're going to start with today is we're going to go back and retrace some steps. And the first person we're going to look at is Immanuel Kant. Now, I've already introduced Kant in a prior series. So when I went through Weltanschauung, at the very end of that series, I gave a critique of presuppositional apologetics, which largely depends upon Immanuel Kant for their sort of philosophical assumptions. And I only gave you what Kant taught and why I think what he teaches is self-defeating. But what I did not give you is his rationale for believing what he believes. So for the next, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes or so, I'm going to give you again his basic philosophy, because I don't think, Ben, you may have heard what I had to say about Immanuel Kant yet. I'm not sure, have you? You weren't. Yeah, I know you didn't. Weren't here live, but it's recorded, and you may not have gotten to that yet. So you'll get to learn kind of what he was, what he did, and all that. And then what I will do is we will move on to look at his actual reasons for believing what he believed. Okay, so who was Immanuel Kant, and what did he do, and what did he say, and what did he believe, and why is this relevant to what we're doing? Well, the fact of the matter is, Immanuel Kant is the reason why most people don't believe the Bible. The fact of the matter is, Immanuel Kant is the grandfather of liberal theology. The fact of the matter is that most isms that came after the year 1800 can be traced in one way or another back to him. So his shadow looms large over the modern world. He's a watershed philosopher without whom we would not be wrestling with any of the issues that we wrestle with today. in fact, I dare say that if you were to go to your average pastor living in the years before 1800, it would not surprise me at all if the majority of them said, yes, I can know God exists. I know God exists rationally. I can prove that God exists. That would be on the tongues of many, many, many a pastor living in the years prior to 1800. After 1800, it's really hard to find a pastor that's going to say that, and that gets truer and truer as you go into the 20th century and now into the 21st century. I dare say that if you went to most pastors living today and went to their church and said, can you prove rationally that God exists, I'm willing to bet that they would say no. Why? Well, the fact of the matter is, and I'll put it very baldly to you, they've been influenced by Immanuel Kant more than they've been influenced by Jesus Christ. Now, that doesn't mean that they...
His critique of pure reason?
I'm sorry?
That all came from his critique of pure reason?
His critical philosophy in general, but his critique of pure reason more than any other book. And I'm not saying that these pastors that I'm thinking of, hypothetically in a lot of ways, I'm not saying that they've read Immanuel Kant. So most people have not read Immanuel Kant. So he's not influenced people directly in the sense that people imbibe him and go, yeah, he's right about all of this, and they move on. But he basically said a handful of things, which if you look at the way people think today, that's kind of how they think, even though they don't really know what the source of all this is. So he is, when I say he's important, I mean, that's just like a major understatement. He's the reason why apologetics has become so necessary. Think about that. I mean, you know, in the years prior to 1800, there were apologetically oriented pastors like a Jonathan Edwards, but they were few and far between. I mean, most of your pastors delivered the scriptures to their congregation, and they just said, took it for granted that, yeah, God's existence is easily provable. I mean, look at nature. Look at its orderly development. Clearly, God, there must be an order to all this. And so that wasn't even really on people's radar. Among the intelligentsia in certain universities, certain battles would take place between those who thought God existed and those who didn't. But the vast majority of people continue to believe that God exists and that God could be proven, even though there were some people running around saying the opposite. It really wasn't until David Hume came along and then Immanuel Kant that it just became fashionable to become an atheist in the 19th century. And then Darwin was kind of the linchpin to really make it real. So even though Kant and Hume destroyed in the minds of many the natural theology, basically, natural theology kind of limped along in the 19th century until Darwin came. And when Darwin gave his scientific explanation for how species develop, that was sort of the linchpin in everything. And that's why Dawkins will say, Darwin taught us how to be intellectually fulfilled atheists. But Darwin could not be if it weren't for Hume and Kant. So in order to understand Immanuel Kant, you have to understand a little bit about David Hume. David Hume was a British philosopher. He was an empiricist. And he wrote a book called An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. And we will be reading a couple of essays from that book in the weeks to come. So you're actually going to read Hume firsthand as well. But Hume actually gave a very interesting argument proving that science is impossible. And his book was not widely read, or at least widely influential, until Immanuel Kant read it. So, but before I even get to Kant, let's look at Hume for a minute. He dies in 1776. No other special events happened that year, as y'all know. So you can easily remember that year. So he dies in 1776, a few months actually before the Revolution. He was a librarian. He couldn't get an appointment teaching philosophy anywhere. He wrote a history of England. He wrote a treatise on human nature, which he said fell stillborn from the press. But the book that really has given him fame, really two books, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, which is really his critique of natural theology as a whole, and his Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, where he gives a series of arguments, among them his famous argument against miracles. And so one of the things that we're going to be reading in the coming weeks is his essay against miracles. Hume gave the following argument, which was, again, as I say, very interesting. If you are a pure empiricist, meaning that you believe all knowledge begins at sensation, that we only know what we perceive, then the idea of induction is virtually impossible to establish. Now, what is induction? Induction is the form of reasoning where we reason from particular observations to general conclusions. And if you don't know by now, that's what science is. Scientists utilize inductive reasoning to come to all of their conclusions. This is why you never call a scientific proof a sound proof. You always call it inductively strong or inductively weak, as the case may be. And so what do scientists have to assume before they can say that their general conclusion is inductively strong? What do they have to assume about the world? Well, one of the things that they have to assume about the world is that the future is going to be like the past. Okay? If I make a scientific judgment, what I'm really saying is that the world acts this way and will continue to act this way, probably. Right? At a certain temperature, water will freeze if put in that temperature. Okay? And I've observed this so many times that it's highly probable that the next time I put a glass of water in 32 degrees Fahrenheit or below, it's going to freeze. So far, so good? So what induction presupposes, therefore, is that the future is going to be like the past. So my question to you is, how do you know that? Remember, become an empiricist with me. The only thing I know is what I can see and observe, what I can touch, taste, and feel, what I can experience. How do you know that the future is going to be like the past?
You can't.
That's what he says. You can't know that the future is going to be like the past. Now, here's what some people might say. They might say, wait a minute, all my life, the future has been like the past. For example, On Monday, I put my glass in a refrigerator, or in a freezer rather, and it froze. And the next day, I left my glass of water outside, and it froze overnight, and the water itself froze. And Friday, the same thing happened, similar thing happened. So I know that water under these conditions freezes. And since I have multiple past experiences in which the future was like the past, right, I can know that very probably the future from my reference point will be like the past.
Assuming no change in conditions.
That is exactly right, but it's also assuming that the future is going to be like the past. In other words, you're reasoning in a circle. How do you know it's really probable that the future is going to be like the past? Because all past observations of that happening yielded that result. And therefore, probably the future will be like the past. Well, all those past observations of futures are now in the past. How do you know that they yield any conclusions about how the future is going to be? You don't. And so guess what scientists do whenever they do their research? They take a big step of faith. Y'all see the problem?
Well, I see mine.
You see your problem?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we're talking about scientific principles like water freezing at 32 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Then, yeah, I think you can say that it's very probable that it's always going to freeze as long as it's 32 degrees.
But that's based on your past observations of 32 degrees yielding freezing water. How do you know that that is going to be true in the future? You can't say all past observations of that happening are true because we're talking about the future.
The probability.
But even that is a problem.
That occur if you repeat the scientific experiment over and over. And even though the future, you can't know it to be the past, I mean, we live that way. We live based on...
By the way, he's not saying, for example, that the science doesn't work. He's just raising a philosophical question. How do you know that your inductive inferences are reliable?
Because the probability is so great. You know, that you, when you get to a certain... in other words, you can't know that the future is going to be like the past, but because... That's the only, you know, senses that we can go on.
Okay, he's not denying that that's the only thing we can go on. He's simply saying you don't know the future is going to be like the past. Why? Because all past observations of futures being like the past are in the past. And we're not talking about the past observations of futures being like the past. We're talking about our future. And you can't know that future is going to be like the present. You just don't know that.
Well, I know that water freezes at 32 degrees. I mean, it's a lot.
You know that in the past it has done that, but you don't know that it's going to happen in the future. If you say, my past observations of that proves to me that it will do so in the future, all you're really doing is saying the future is going to be like the past. You're begging the question. My question is, how do you know that? And appealing to past experiences to yield the idea that the future is going to be like the past is begging the question.
I guess I would say given the same conditions as a preface.
But that's the very thing that you don't know. Given the same conditions, you don't know.
You don't know the conditions.
Even if I grant the same conditions, you don't know that the future is going to be like them.
Than water that is static and not moving.
Yeah, but that's all based on past observations.
You don't know it until you do it.
Exactly. So you can't come to general scientific conclusions about how the world will work in the future.
You can then, because at that point it's no longer the future. It was part of the future.
And now what do you know? You know the present, and that's all you know.
Right. But we proved that point, which if you do repeat that multiple times, your probability of it happening again from what we go on.
That's all based on past observations. See, now your present becomes your past. And so the question is, how is the future going to be like the past?
Well, it was the past, but then the future becomes what comes next. So
I understand that, but the point is, okay, so I've observed water.
I haven't dropped this paper, but I'm thinking it's going to drop based on the past. Mm-hmm. I don't know that to be the case. Now it's the past.
All right. Okay, and then your assumption was confirmed, right? Okay.
So you live on that.
Well, all past observations of water freezing at 32 degrees proves what? That all my observations in the past yielded water freezing at 32 degrees.
Okay.
Now, I'm saying the future is going to act the same way. In the future, when I put water in that same condition, it's going to freeze. How do I know that? Well, all past observations of futures can't really tell me for sure. I have to take a step of faith. And see, the reason there's a big push against this, because it kind of smacks against common sense, but that's what philosophers do. Philosophers ask questions that people of common sense don't really wish to ask. But he's raising a really interesting question. What is the foundation or standard by which you know that the future is going to be like the past?
Sound like you can know anything other than what's
well, that's exactly what Hume is getting at. There's not a whole lot you can know. Now, Hume is going to end up being a radical skeptic, because I can't know induction, therefore I can't really know that science is valid.
So how does he know that?
Well, he knows that he can't know.
How does he know?
Well, on one level, yeah, I can just agree with his conclusion just outright, but on another level, you raise another interesting point, because Hume himself engages in inductive reasoning because he knows that all past experiences of him writing a book yielded ink and words on a paper, and therefore as he begins to write this book, he's using induction to do that. So in one sense, you can say, you're taking no less a leap of faith than I am. Now, he would say, yes. And that's, he goes, sometimes when I think about this stuff, it gives me a headache, and that's why I go play a game of backgammon. So we should all just stop doing what we're doing and go engage in some form of recreation. But of course, a game of backgammon utilizes induction too. And so how do you know that the rules are going to be the same this time you play backgammon? Right. So in one sense, this kind of skepticism becomes self-defeating. But on another level, he raises a really important question. What are the foundations of science? And the American scientist will say, well, it just works, so I don't want to think about that. But I think an intellectual, a true intellectual, who doesn't really embrace pragmatism, can raise some really good questions. What are the foundations of even doing science in the first place? There's another problem that he raises, and that's the law of causality. And we've already talked about that in relation to the contingency argument, but it just would behoove us to at least mention the fact that we can't always know that those things that we think are effects of causes are really effects of specific causes. We run into the problem of begging the question and even engaging in the post hoc fallacy often. After this, because of this. Right? Post hoc, ergo, propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of this. Now, the rooster crows, the sun rises. Ergo, therefore, the rooster caused the sun to rise. Well, that's the post hoc fallacy. Now, we've already addressed this on one level, but it's these problems, establishing the true intellectual foundations of science, that got Kant to begin thinking about these things a little bit differently. The other thing that David Hume did is he destroyed, to his own satisfaction, the traditional arguments for God's existence, which would lead us, apparently, to atheism. And so Immanuel Kant says in his Prolegomena concerning any future metaphysic, which is really his distilled version of the Critique of Pure Reason, he says, in reading David Hume, I was awakened from my dogmatic slumbers. Now, Kant was not originally an empiricist. He was a rationalist, meaning that all knowledge begins in the mind. And the older term for rationalism is dogmatism. That's what a dogmatist was in the 18th century. Someone who just believed as Plato did, as Descartes did, as Leibniz did, as Christian Wolff did, that all knowledge begins in the mind. And so when Immanuel Kant says, in reading David Hume, I was awakened from my dogmatic slumbers, what he's saying is that David Hume convinced me to no longer be a rationalist. And so he sets forth his critical philosophy. And the Critique of Pure Reason was written in 1781. A second edition was written in 1791. And then on the basis of what he establishes there, he constructs a critical philosophy. So he has a Critique of Practical Reason. He has a Groundwork for the Metaphysical Morals. He has all kinds of books written on various philosophical topics whereby he tries to show that A, his critical philosophy is true, and B, it can answer some of the philosophical conundra that we often encounter in our day-to-day lives, especially the issue of morals. So he's often considered one of the great moral philosophers along with other issues, okay? So what did he say? How does he, in his words, save science and make room for faith? That's what he wants to do. He wants to save the practice of science on a theoretical basis, not just a pragmatic basis, it works, but on a theoretical basis, and he wants to make room for faith. He wants to make it possible for you to exercise faith in your religion. And before I even take another step, you have to understand that Kant is an interesting fellow because he grew up in Germany. He's a German philosopher. He taught at in the city of Königsberg, which is in Prussia, and he was raised by a Pietist family. And Pietism was kind of catching on in the early 18th century. And so by the time Kant comes along, he's imbibed this as a young man, as a young Christian. And Pietism is really the belief that these theologians that are sitting around talking about how many angels dance on the head of a pin and are, you know, constructing these systems of theology, they're wasting their time. God is meant to be experienced and felt. God is meant to be known through experience, through emotions. And so when I go to the church worship service and I emotionally engage myself in the worship, that's how I come to know God. And I actually belittle faith itself by engaging in a long-winded process where I try to prove things. Okay? So what Kant does is he leaves that Pietistic background, goes to the university, imbibes the Wolffian, Leibnizian rationalism that he was taught to believe, and he becomes a big believer in the theistic proofs, at least the ontological argument, and even Leibniz's version of the cosmological argument. Well, when Hume awakes him from his dogmatic slumbers, he has to reconstruct everything. And he's got to make room for faith. That's his pietism speaking. But he also has to save science. That is his newfound empiricism or rational empiricism thinking. He's going to try to wed empiricism with rationalism and create a new kind of epistemology, a theory of knowledge. Okay. So what does he do? This line represents what we can't know. What is above this line is what we can't know. And this is what he called the noumenal world. What is the noumenal world? The noumenal world is the thing in itself. The noumena, the things, as they really are. And what exists in this noumenal world? God, the soul, and the world as a whole. Those things exist in the noumenal world. Down here is the world of perceptions.
or the phenomenal world. So we have a distinction between phenomena and noumena. The distinction between the thing in itself and how it appears to me. Okay? Now, according to Kant, there are certain categories that the human mind has just at birth. So here I am, I'm born into this world, and my mind has certain categories inside it, just born with it. For example, the laws of logic. Or metaphysical categories like contingency. Okay? And these principles are called the transcendentals, the preconditions for knowing anything whatsoever. What's an example of a transcendental or a category of thought without which you can't know anything? Logic. The law of contradiction says two contradictory statements cannot both be true at the same time and in the same sense. If I weren't born with that law, I couldn't know the world around me. Another category is the law of causality. Effects must have causes, or for every event I see, there must be a cause. If I didn't have that law in my mind, judging the world around me, I couldn't know the world. So far, so good. Now, here's the key. In order to save science and make room for faith, he says these categories of the mind only apply to phenomena. They only apply to phenomena. What would be phenomena? Science. History. Math. The subjects that you guys learned in school. That's what you know. That's what these laws of logic, the law of causality, these categories that we have, that's what they can obtain. You can know how the world appears to you through the sciences, through history, and so forth. So far, so good? What can't these categories apply to? Can I know God? According to Immanuel Kant?
No.
No. The categories cannot penetrate this barrier. The categories cannot be applied to metaphysical truths like the idea of soul or the idea of God or the world as a whole. Now, you can believe in those things. I've made room for faith. But you can't rationally know them. I've saved science. I've made science its own sphere of study without any worry that occultic causes will penetrate in the world and mess up my scientific theories. By the way, this was a problem that Hume ran into. Hume was well aware of the occasionalists who were philosophers following Descartes, and the occasionalists said, we don't know if secondary causality even occurs in the world. So, for example, I go up to the pool table, and I take my cue stick, and I hit the cue ball, and the cue ball hits the eight ball, and the eight ball goes into the pocket. What do I see? Well, I see one event happening after another, like a film reel, right? One frame after another. But I don't see the necessary connection between these events. And therefore, the occasionalist would say, that you didn't really cause the cue stick to move, which caused the cue ball to hit the eight ball that caused the eight ball to go into the pocket. What you saw was the occasion God took to cause all that stuff himself. And so it wasn't really you doing it. It was God doing it. Does it make sense? And that's one of the things that David Hume said. He said, well, if that's a possibility, then I can't really know that anything is happening in the world according to natural law. So far, so good. So what does Kant do? He says, all right, we're going to get rid of all that. The categories of the mind cannot be applied to God, the soul, or the world as a whole, and therefore occasionalism will never raise this ugly head when we do our science. Yes?
Well, it seems like in that example, we're asking two different questions, though. What happened that we observe through the history element.
Mm-hmm.
But if we say that God caused that to happen, then we're touching back on the why. Not so much as the how.
Here's how I think Kant might handle that question. He would say, how do you know why God does anything? And since you can't know why God does anything, that is another indication that your powers of logic can't penetrate into the noumenal world.
I would probably say they don't have to.
Well, we'll address that in a minute, but let's take this a little bit further, okay? At this point in the discussion, Christians smile. And they say, okay, great. I don't know God rationally. It's a faith issue. Right? So far, so good, right? And here's the implication of this. If our powers of reasoning cannot apply to God in any way, shape, or form, then we can't know God, and therefore there's no natural theology. Natural theology is dead. Natural theology cannot be true. There's no such thing as a sound argument for God's existence if Kant is right. In principle. Have you ever offered these arguments to some people and they just plain look incredulous? They don't really locate the problem. They can't really locate the problem, but they don't want to clutch in. Why? Well, one reason that Christians offer is that humans are naturally resistant to embracing God's truth. But I would also offer a socio-cultural reason why. Kant is in the air. This is kind of a presupposition that you just catch when you're growing up, that you can't really know these things. Right? And so, when the natural theologian comes along and offers his cosmological argument, don't really know what the problem is, but I just am not buying what you're saying. Because, I don't know, it just doesn't seem rational to think that we can know these things. Has this person ever read Immanuel Kant in his whole life? No. Has he ever sat under a professor who's ever read Kant in his whole life? Not unless he's taken some philosophy courses. But it's there. Now, some Christians smile. They keep smiling. Yes, finally. Get rid of the natural theology. Great. Awesome. Beautiful. Boy, we just wasted our time, didn't we, over the past year or so talking about cosmological arguments and Kalam arguments and Leibnizian arguments and ontological arguments. All that stuff was a waste of time. Because you can't do a natural theology. You can't know God through that. How do we know God then? And here's when the presuppositionalists of our day and a lot of Reformed Christians and a lot of Christians in general will smile and say, that's the beauty of Christianity. You see, God is up here and he penetrated that barrier and he gave us He gave us the Bible. And the Bible is the Word of God. It is God speaking to us. And in His grace, He penetrated what we can't penetrate. Just as there is a moral barrier between us and God, sin, there is an intellectual barrier between us and God. And God penetrated that and gave us His revelation through His Word. So all you have to do is start with the Bible, Dr. Campbell. You've been wasting the time of these guys who've been coming and listening to your lectures, and they're like, okay, I think I get this argument, all that, and they put pressure on themselves to try to learn this stuff. Waste of time. Teach them Genesis and Revelation and all the books in between. Don't waste your time with natural theology. Y'all think that that's a good argument for Christianity right there?
I think you're winding up and about to deliver
something. You're going to hesitate. What about you, Lance?
Not a good answer. That's circular.
It is circular, but here's a more fundamental reason why it's not a good answer.
Work for Islam.
Well, there you go. It would work for Islam. How do you know the Bible, which holy book we're going to talk about, the Quran or the Bible? But here's even something more fundamentally worse. In embracing Kant, you destroyed revealed theology, sacred theology, too. Where was the Bible produced? You could be very general here. Was it produced in the phenomenal realm, or was it produced in heaven, in the noumenal realm? Did the Bible fall out of heaven into the lap of King James, who signed it and said, here we go, it's the Word of God? It was written by men throughout history. So where is the Bible located? It's located down here in the phenomenal realm. What language is the Bible written in? You don't have to give me specifics. Is it human language or angelic language? It's human language, produced by the categories of human thought. And since it's human language produced by human categories, it is nothing more than a piece of phenomena that is wholly grounded in this world. It's just a human story. No, it's the Word of God. How do you know that? Well, there are prophecies in the Bible that came true. All those prophecies were either misinterpreted by the early Christians or they were written after the fact. What else you got? Jesus rose from the dead. Impossible. What else you got? You see the problem here? This is the biggest problem. This is the complacency that Christians have when they encounter Immanuel Kant, intellectual Christians, and they say, oh, God solves the problem by revelation. What are you talking about? How do you know this is a revelation? Kant would say. And anything I use to argue for revelation at that point is nothing but a circular argument, which begs the question. He's already destroyed Christianity by setting up the equation this way. Once this is in place, Christianity is done for. Because you can't know God. You just can't. Questions?
How does he know that?
Ah, we're about to read him. So this is kind of where I left off in the lectures of Melanchthon. I stopped there, and I went ahead and did my internal critique of this, and then we talked about presuppositional apologetics, okay? But that's what we're going to do today. Your question is, how does he know that? That's a very good question.
How does he know what the future's going to hold with God?
Very good. All that stuff. I will say this. His answer to how we justify induction regarding scientific knowledge, he would say, without induction, I can't know anything. It's a category of the human mind. And as long as I apply it merely to phenomena, to the sciences, to history, to math, to whatever, as long as I apply induction to the things that are grounded in this world, I'm fine. It's when I try to use my induction to understand the soul, that's when things get kind of weird. Right? Now let me Before I answer your question directly, before we go through his proofs that this philosophy is true, let me draw out one more implication, okay? How does this translate into theology? Okay, in philosophy, it's the distinction between the noumena and the phenomena. In theology, it's the distinction between faith and reason. Okay, let's just have this discussion, right? So you're talking to a liberal theologian, and you say, is Jesus the only way to heaven? Well, he is to me. He's my only way. No, I want to know if he's the only way. Well, I can't speak for everybody. I can only speak of what the Christ has done for me. Yeah, but so you're saying that the Muslim has found God? Sure, the Muslim has found God. He's found God through his way. His way is the Quran. His way is Islam. But the Quran and the Bible contradict each other. So how can you say that Islam is just as valid a way to God as Christianity when they contradict each other? Oh, you see what you're doing? You're taking the categories of human reason and you're applying them to faith. And faith is bigger than your logic. Have you ever seen or heard a guy talk like that to you? I have.
No, I have.
This is it, guys. This is the heart of the matter in our modern world. This philosophy creates that kind of dichotomy. And so, what do we have to do? Well, what does Paul say that we have to do? The Apostle Paul. He says we destroy arguments and everything that would lift up itself against the knowledge of God. Paul says we need to use our intellects to knock down these kinds of philosophies that would presume that we can't know God. Kant's philosophy is really not that new. You can find it in medieval theologians before him, but he's the guy that articulated it in a way, for some reason it caught on. And it was one of those, it's kind of like Mein Kampf, you know? It's just one of those books that everyone had but no one read and just sort of seeped into the culture. And it makes things very easy. If you become a liberal theologian, things get easy for you. I don't have to worry about reconciling the Bible to science. The Bible is a book of faith. Yeah, but there's arguments suggesting that Jericho never happened. Yes, but just because it didn't happen in history doesn't mean it's not a true matter of faith. Who is Jesus? Well, we've got to make a distinction between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. The Jesus of history was just a regular guy that walked around and died. But the Christ of faith is eternal. He lives forevermore. See how this works? Do y'all have a question? So, is it not a long line from Immanuel Kant to Friedrich Schleiermacher, the father of modern theology, and then from him comes, you know, people like Tillich, and then more popularizers like John Shelby Spong. I mean, it's all over the place. There's a Presbyterian minister that I've dialogued with through email, through messages. I've sent him some rude messages. But PCUSA, he's an atheist, a self-proclaimed atheist. He's a minister. He's the pastor of a church.
Of a PCA church?
PCUSA.
PCUSA.
See, God is just a construct of the categories of my experience. I have no idea if what's the category of my experience. I have no idea if there really is a God out there that's beyond those categories. Have any questions, Lance, besides how does he know this? Anything before we jump into this? Because it's about to get fun, because we're about to finally start reading.
I'm going to sum all this up in one sentence. How would you do it?
Well, what
Well, it's two phrases separated by a semicolon, and I'll unpack it for you. Concepts without percepts are blind. Percepts without concepts are blank. Percepts without concepts are blind. Concepts without percepts are blank. So what he does is he takes concepts, the concepts of the mind, like the laws of logic, and they exist in the human mind, and they are used to interpret the phenomena that I see. Without the laws of logic, I can't interpret what I'm seeing. But without my perceptions, the laws of logic are just a blank slate. There's no content to them. So for Kant, the mind is kind of like an ice tray, one of the old ice trays that you put in the freezer. And those ice cubes, all that you can really produce in that ice tray are ice cubes. You can't produce trees with those cubes. You can't produce what doesn't fit into the cubes. And since God and the soul and the world as a whole can't fit into those cubes, those little indentions in the tray, then God can't fit in there. Therefore, your concepts cannot comprehend or even know about whether there's a God or not. So, summarizing his philosophy in a nutshell, the mind cannot know God because the mind is grounded in simply the things we see. The mind can only know what appears to it, not what is metaphysically beyond it.
I think the one thing I take away from looking at everything written up there, that seemed right to me, it's not that we couldn't go through this barrier to know this, it had to be given down to us.
Well, what I would say to pick up on what you're saying that God can really penetrate that barrier. I would say God has so made me so that there is no barrier to begin with. This is just words and symbols on a board. It doesn't really exist. It's a myth.
Sure.
And that's what we're going to try to show. But why does Kant say this? The first thing we got to ask is, why does he come to this conclusion? And that takes us to his antinomies. Now, what he does is he gives us four antinomies. By an antinomy, he means the following. Logic can prove this, and it can also prove its exact opposite. So let's look at the first antinomy, just to illustrate the point very quickly. On page 396... the first conflict of transcendental ideas, this is the antinomy of pure reason, the first conflict of transcendental ideas, what is the thesis? Well, the thesis is that the world has a beginning in time and is also limited as regards to space. And what he's saying is that the human mind can offer proofs for this. Are y'all following me so far? And then what's the antithesis? The antithesis is contrary, or contradictory. The world has no beginning and no limits in space. It is infinite as regards to both time and space. Now you'll notice that these are contradictories. These are not merely contraries, meaning that one has to be true and the other has to be false. And since reason can conjure up proofs for both, what does that mean? It means that reason can't know which one is true. And that's why it's an antinomy. We're stuck. We just don't know. And your problem is you're trying to take the categories of the mind, the transcendental ideas, and apply them to the world as a whole. In this case, does the world have a beginning? Well, here's a proof that it did. Well, is the world eternal? Well, here's another proof that it is eternal. What's the problem? Since reason yields two contradictory conclusions, reason can't know. So far, so good. And that's his proof that this is true. So y'all ready to go through the proofs? All right, so the thesis. Let's look at the proof for the thesis. If you look on page 397, the proof for the thesis is on the left, and the proof for the antithesis is on the right. So let's look at the proof for the thesis. If we assume that the world has no beginning in time, then up to every given moment an eternity has elapsed, and there has passed away in the world an infinite series of successive states of things. Now, the infinity of a series consists in the fact that it can never be completed through successive synthesis. It thus follows that it is impossible for an infinite world series to have passed away, and that a beginning of the world is therefore a necessary condition of the world's existence. This was the first point that called for proof. Stop, full stop. What has he just given us? What does that sound like to you?
It sounds like something we discussed earlier.
Yes, and what would that discussion be about? He's given us the Kalam cosmological argument. The impossibility of traversing an infinite through successive addition. So he's given us our proof that the world had a beginning. So far, so good? What about the second point, that the world has to be limited with regards to space? As regards the second point, let us again assume the opposite, namely that the world is an infinite given whole of coexisting things. Now, the magnitude of a quantum, which is not given in intuition, as within certain limits, can be thought only through the synthesis of its parts, and the totality of such a quantum only through a synthesis that is brought to completion through repeated addition, unit to unit. In order, therefore, to think as a whole, the world which fills all space is the successive synthesis of the parts of an infinite world must be viewed as completed. That is, an infinite time must be viewed as having elapsed in the enumeration of all coexisting things. This, however, is impossible. An infinite aggregate of actual things cannot therefore be viewed as a given whole, nor consequently as simultaneously given. What is he arguing against? He's arguing against the existence of an actually infinite number of things. Do you see that? See you guys nodding your head, I guess. The world is, therefore, as regards extension and space, not infinite, but is enclosed within limits. This was the second point in dispute. Okay, so what if we just did a full stop here? What should we do to Immanuel Kant? We should say, thank you. You just backed up our Kalam cosmological argument. So far, so good? Okay, so he's going to smile and go, well, you got to read the antithesis then. Because reason can prove the antithesis just as easily as it can prove the thesis. So y'all ready for the antithesis? Back to 397, on the right-hand column, he says, for let us assume that the world has a beginning. Since the beginning is an existence, which is preceded by a time in which the thing is not, there must have been a preceding time in which the world was not, that is, an empty time. Now, no coming to be of a thing is possible in an empty time, because no part of such a time possesses, as compared with any other, a distinguishing condition of existence rather than of non-existence. And this applies whether the thing is supposed to arise of itself or through some other cause. In the world, many series of things can indeed begin, but the world itself cannot have a beginning and is therefore infinite in respect of past time. I want to stop there. You can, on your own, read the rest, but I think that we have the refutation of his antithesis. And what is our refutation of his antithesis? You guys have been studying natural theology for a year now. How do we refute the antithesis?
Because he is assuming, or it seems like he's saying, there was a time in which the world didn't exist, but not only did the world not exist, but time didn't.
All right, Ben, A+. Very good. So what does the classical tradition teach about time? Augustine said it best. He says the beginning of the world was not a beginning in time, but the beginning of time. And once we grant that time began to exist when the world began to exist, we avoid Kant's antithesis, and therefore his first antinomy is null and void. We can thank him for backing up our Kalam argument,
point out the unsoundness of the antithesis and move on. By the way, quote Stephen Hawking, everyone now believes that the universe and time itself began at the Big Bang. So it's not just a postulate of classical theists like Augustine, it's a postulate of modern physics. So far, so good? By the way, this is a fun exercise. J. Gresham Machen, the great conservative theologian, said this, because I will not take my ordination vows until I answer Kant to my own satisfaction. And Christianity and Liberalism was a book that he wrote, but even before that book, he knew where the source of the problems were, the sources of the problems were. And so he spent his time, even though he was an expert in the New Testament, he knew that he had to get acquainted with Immanuel Kant and answer him. And so that's a man of integrity, right? He says, I'm not going to go a step further until I deal with Kant. And then once I can answer Kant to my own satisfaction, I can with integrity move forward.
Who was that?
J. Gresham Machen, one of my heroes. Flawed as all men are, but he's the founder of Westminster Seminary, and he wrote a book that is prophetic called Christianity and Liberalism, showing that these are not two... Christianity and liberalism... Liberalism is not a version of Christianity, but a different religion altogether. So on page 402, we go to the second antinomy. I'm of course, not going to read everything I'm giving to you. And it would be awesome if next week when we come back and we deal with another issue that maybe we can start with y'all just asking questions about what you read last week. But I'm giving you the general program as to how to handle these antinomies. So the second antinomy begins on page 402. And I find this to be interesting as well. So here's the thesis. Every composite substance in the world is made up of simple parts. And nothing anywhere exists save the simple or what is composed of the simple. Okay, so far, so good. What is a simple part? It's a part that is irreducible. Once you get to that thing, usually conceived among atheists, yeah, as a bit of matter, once you get to that, it is uncomposed of anything. It is a simple part. Okay? Does that make sense? So everything that you run into is either simple or a composite of various simple things. So to give you an example, this podium that I'm looking at here is, if we reduce it down to its basic constituents, you will see that it's just made up of tiny bits of matter, each bit of which is not reducible to something else. You can't break it up into something else. Okay, and the older school of thought, the classical philosopher said it's the atom. Atom means literally unbreakable or uncuttable, that which cannot be cut, atom. And in our day, it's the quark. It's the smallest bit of matter that we're aware of. So far, so good. So everything that exists is composed of simple parts and or reducible to those simple substances. Okay? That's the thesis. The antithesis is this. No composite thing in the world is made up of simple parts, and there nowhere exists in the world anything simple. Well, this just followed the proofs, okay? So let's look at the proof for the thesis. It's right under it, left column. Let us assume that composite substances are not made up of simple parts. If all composition be then removed in thought, no composite part, and since we admit no simple parts, also no simple part, that is to say nothing at all will remain. And accordingly, no substance will be given. Either, therefore, it is impossible to remove in thought all composition, or after its removal, there must remain something which exists without composition, that is, the simple. In the former case, the composite would not be made up of substances. Composition, as applied to substances, is only an accidental relation and independence of which they must still persist as self-subsistent beings. Since this contradicts our supposition, there remains only the original supposition. that a composite of substances in the world is made up of simple parts. It follows, as an immediate consequence, that the things in the world are all, without exception, simple beings, that composition is merely an external state of these beings, and that although we can never so isolate these elementary substances as to take them out of this state of composition, reason must think them as the primary subjects of all composition, and therefore as simple beings prior to all composition. Okay? So, what do I do? Do I go ahead and just debunk this? Or do I read? Did y'all follow that line of reasoning? Or do y'all want me to walk you through it a little bit? Huh?
I underline one part of it.
Okay, so go ahead and tell me what you underline.
Composition as applied to substances is only accidental relation and independence of which they must still persist as self-subsistent beings.
Okay. Purely accidental. Okay, now when metaphysicians use the term accident in the classical sense, they're not speaking of something that wasn't planned. That they don't mean that. It just happened by accident. What they mean is something that is not essential to something else. So Travis Campbell has essential properties, but he also has accidental properties. Well, can we name some accidental properties? Well, the fact that I have two arms and two legs. You remove my arms, I'm still me. And therefore, the arms that I possess are accidental to who and what I am. That's a classical way of thinking of things. Now, obviously, I'm not going to be as happy as I am now without my arms. No one's suggesting that if you remove the arms, you're going to get along just fine or as equally well as when you had them. But the point is you're not going to say that I'm no longer human because I lost my arms. So far, so good?
I think so. I mean, but it seems like they're confusing your physical makeup with your identity.
Okay. Then you would say, and there are people that would agree with you, they would say, well, I am not my material self. I'm actually more fundamentally soul or spirit. And so you would say, or somebody of your ilk would say, the body is accidental to what I am. So one property that I have is a physical body. So there's nothing about my physical makeup that's essential to me because the real me is the soul. And so that would be one other way to look at it. So as long as you understand what an accidental property is, then you can follow this line of reasoning. So what he says is, either, therefore, it is impossible to remove in thought all composition, or after its removal, there must remain something which exists without composition, that is the simple. In the former case, the composite would not be made up of substances. Composition, as applied to substances, is only an accidental relation in independence of which they must still persist as self-subsistent beings. In other words, once you take all the parts of me and divide them into their basic, most fundamental parts, what you end up with is just a bunch of simple things that can exist on their own. And they just all happen to collide and make me, me.
I guess when I read this, the first thing I was thinking of are the physical elements of creation.
Mm-hmm.
Our world, our planet,
mm-hmm.
our universe.
Sure.
Yeah,
I'm just using this as an illustration, but you can do this with anything. He's saying, going back even further, if all composition be then removed in thought, no composite part, and also no simple part, that is to say, nothing at all will remain, and accordingly, no substances will be given. Either, therefore, it is impossible to remove in thought all composition, or after its removal, there must remain something which exists without composition, that is the simple. Now, what's really interesting about what Kant is doing here is he's actually giving a version of the ontological argument. I don't even think he knows it. He's saying that it's impossible for us to conceive of nothing. You're either going to conceive of the composite or the simple.
And so once again, we can thank him. Thank you, Mr. Kant. You just proved to us that a logically necessary being exists. Do you see how I got to that conclusion? If all composition be then removed in thought, no composite part and also no simple part, that is to say, nothing at all will remain, and accordingly, no substance will be given. Well, on that assumption, if there's no composite and no simple, that means that there's nothing in our thoughts. There's absolutely nothing. Right? If I remove all composition, then that's what I have. I have nothing in my mind. But then he says, either, therefore, it is impossible to remove in thought all composition, or after its removal, there must remain something which exists without composition, that is a simple. In other words, it's impossible for me to mentally get rid of any and all things. I cannot think of nothing, because when I think of nothing, I'm still thinking of something.
It's kind of like the void we talked about.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to understand where exactly
the building seems to be. What the critics will tell you is that he's not really set up an antinomy. Notice he says, no composite thing in the world, this is the antithesis, is made up of simple parts, and there nowhere exists in the world anything simple. That's the opposite. And what is his proof? He says, assume that a composite thing is made up of simple parts. Since all external relation and therefore all composition of substances is possible only in space, a space must be made up of as many parts as are contained in the composite which occupies it. So what he's really saying here is he's actually talking about space and spatial relations in the antithesis, but in the thesis he's actually talking about matter and its relationship to other bits of matter. Now, a thesis and antithesis must concern arguments concerning the very same thing you're talking about. Like in the first antinomy, he's talking about the world, and the world either has a beginning or it doesn't. Here, he's saying matter either is composed of simple parts or composites, or In the antithesis, he's talking about space and its relations. He's not talking about matter, really. And therefore, since he's talking about two different things in his antinomy, it's not an antinomy.
Yeah, it sounds like he's betting on a two-horse race and equal amount of
each. Well, you've actually, what you're saying is very similar to what Norman Kemp Smith said. He's playing both sides of the game, but he's not really proving anything. Now, here's what's really interesting. Look at the thesis here. He says, every composite substance in the world is made up of simple parts, and nothing anywhere exists save the simple or what is composed of the simple. Now, if you're talking about what is in the world, here's what I could say. Nothing in the world is simple. Everything in the world, including my soul, is a composite. And this is Thomistic metaphysics in a nutshell. Only God is non-composite, and God is not in the world. At least God is not of the world. He's in it in the sense that he's omnipresent, but God is not a worldly being. And therefore, when we're talking about the contingent things in our world, everything that we encounter in our world is a composite. Everything is composed. Nothing is simple, including my soul. My soul is a combination, a composite of essence and existence, or actuality and potentiality. And so I can just look at him here and say, nothing anywhere exists save the simple or what is composed of the simple. I would simply say that everything that I encounter that is composed is fundamentally composed. Nothing is simple in the world. And he might say, well, what accounts for its composition? Ah, anything that is composed has to have a cause. And since everything in the world is composed, the world as a whole has to have a cause. So what he's really doing here, even though he's playing both sides of the fence and all that, and he's kind of being confusing, he's actually giving us grounds for affirming Edwards's ontological argument. I can't think of nothing, because when I think of nothing, I'm still thinking of something. He's actually saying there has to be a logically necessary being. And he's also giving us reason to embrace a Thomistic metaphysic, in a sense, because he's, so if I start thinking of the things in my world as fundamentally simple and they're just composed of simple things, I'm not really getting at the truth of things, because nothing that is contingent is really simple. Nothing contingent is metaphysically simple. And therefore, this first thesis is not really a well-worded thesis. It's not something that I would really embrace, unless we wanted to say the only thing that exists once you remove all contingency is the one true God who is absolutely simple. But that's what we believe as theists. Does that make sense to all of you, or both of you?
Some of it's coming around. It's very confusing, the way he says this, because, like I say, he seems like he's taking the pro-con and not really staking out a position.
Kant was...
Everything in the world is composed. Everything that's composed needs a cause.
There has to be a cause of the composite world we live in. So, in other words, I'm doing is I'm tweaking his thesis a little bit, and I'm showing you how you can actually use it to prove God.
He's done that 2 times in a row now.
Right. He's given us ammunition to think that our theistic proofs are valid, and that's what I want y'all to conclude. I want y'all to see that the antinomies of Kant don't really prove anything. They certainly don't raise themselves up and destroy the idea that we can know God rationally. They do not destroy natural theology. That's what I want you to walk away with. Now, the third antinomy is on page 409. And he says...
Working out of this book a lot, do you want us to get the book?
No. We will not be... working our way through the Critique of Pure Reason. The Critique of Pure Reason is, without a doubt, the most difficult book I've ever read.
Really? No, I don't want
it. I mean, if you are going to read the Critique of Pure Reason, I would highly recommend that you read his Prolegomena. It's a more difficult title, but it's an easier book. A Prolegomena to any future metaphysic is really his Cliff Notes version of the critique, and it too is difficult. But you at least get to shave off a lot of the rhetoric. Moses Mendelssohn was a Jewish philosopher that Immanuel Kant was good friends with. And when they were young men, they both entered an essay contest, and Mendelssohn defeated him. He won the essay contest. Well, they were friends, and Kant knew that he was not that good of a writer. So he wrote Mendelssohn a letter asking Mendelssohn to read his critique and endorse it, so that, and maybe even write his own books advocating Kant's critical philosophy, because he felt like his philosophy would get a bigger audience if he had someone like Mendelssohn promoting it. Well, Mendelssohn never finished it because he couldn't understand it. And Mendelssohn is one of the smartest people that I've ever heard of, right? So he's brilliant. I read through it from cover to cover because I had help. I read W.T. Jones's History of Philosophy. I have with you right here. Here's the Critique of Pure Reason. And this is the commentary on it. And I read both of these cover to cover at the same time. So I would read like 50 pages here, 50 pages here, and I just went back and forth.
I mean, does it kind of complement each other?
They really help. And it's the same guy that translated the critique here, Norman Kemp Smith, is also the same guy that wrote the commentary. Now, there's a new translation out there that's a little bit more modern, came out in the 90s. I haven't gotten that one, but Kemp Smith was a big help. W.T. Jones was a big help. Sitting in philosophy lectures was a big help. So I had preparation before I got to it, and that's a huge help. But as I've often joked, the two most difficult books I've ever read are Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason and David Lee Roth's Crazy from the Heat. Because Roth, I have no idea what he's talking about. Bolza, bolza, bop, bit of bop. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you saying, man? So, it's a sheer mystery.
So on page 409, here's the thesis. Causality, in accordance with the laws of nature, is not the only causality from which the appearances of the world can one and all be derived. To explain these appearances, it is necessary to assume that there is also another causality, that of freedom. The antithesis, there is no freedom. Everything in the world takes place solely in accordance with the laws of nature. Okay.
Freedom,
Well, let's look at this. He goes, let's assume that there is no other causality than that in accordance with the laws of nature. This being so, everything which takes place presupposes a preceding state upon which it inevitably follows according to a rule. But the preceding state must itself be something which has taken place, having come to be in a time in which it is previously was not. For it had always existed, for if it had always existed, its consequence would also have always existed and would not have only just arisen. Now, we already see the flaw in this argument. He assumes here that all temporal effects must have temporal causes. If it had always existed, its consequence would also have always existed and would not have only just arisen. The causality of the cause through which something takes place is itself, therefore, something that has taken place, which again presupposes, in accordance with the law of nature, a preceding state in this causality, and this in similar manner, a still earlier state, and so on. If, therefore, everything takes place solely in accordance with the laws of nature, there will have always been only a relative and never a first beginning, and consequently no completeness of the series on the side of the causes that arise the one from the other. But the law of nature is just this, that nothing takes place without a cause sufficiently determined a priori. What is he giving us here? He's giving us the principle of sufficient reason. And who gave us an argument for God's existence based on the principle of sufficient reason? His mentor, indirectly at least, Leibniz. So this is a Leibnizian cosmological argument here. Now, since we in this class have already opposed that argument and shown how it is unsound, we can virtually just dismiss this first thesis. But here's what he's trying to say. You got dominoes falling. Each domino in and of itself can't be the sufficient condition for the following of the succeeding domino, because it too fell by a preceding domino. And therefore there must be some causes in the world that are wholly originative. In other words, act of their own free will, apart from the laws of nature. That's what he's trying to get. This is the antinomy of freedom. But then, of course, the antithesis says, there is no freedom. Everything in the world takes place solely in accordance with the laws of nature. Well, how have you proven that? Assume that there is freedom in the transcendental sense as a special kind of causality in accordance with which the events in the world can come about, namely, a power of absolute beginning a state, and therefore also of absolutely beginning a series of consequences of that state. It then follows that not only will a series have its absolute beginning in this spontaneity, but that the very determination of the spontaneity to originate the series, that is to say, the causality itself, will have an absolute beginning. There will be no antecedent through which this act in taking place is determined in accordance with fixed laws. But every beginning of action presupposes a state of not yet acting, of the not yet acting cause, and a dynamical beginning of the action, if it is also a first beginning, presupposes a state which has no causal connection with the preceding state of the cause, that is to say, in no wise follows from it. Transcendental freedom thus stands opposed to the law of causality and the kind of connection which it assumes is holding between the successive states of the act of causes renders all unity of experience impossible. It is not to be met with in any experience and is therefore an empty thought entity. In nature alone, therefore, not in freedom, must we seek for the connection and the order of cosmical events. Freedom, or independence from the laws of nature is no doubt a liberation from compulsion, but also from the guidance of all rules. For it is not permissible to say that the laws of freedom enter into the causality exhibited in the course of nature and so take the place of natural laws. What is he saying? Free will is stupid. He's saying that if I have free will, wholly disconnected from preceding causes, that therefore means that there's no explanation for the movement of my will, and therefore my will acts randomly, or to put it another way, there's no real explanation for the movement of my will, in which case there's no one to praise or blame for the movement of my will. Right? And therefore, free will is irrational. So, what are we looking at? If I don't have freedom, I don't have a sufficient cause of certain events. But if I do have freedom, I have something that's wholly disconnected from preceding causes. Either case, it's all irrational. In other words, I can't use the laws of thought to know metaphysical truths. In this case, the movement of the soul or the freedom of the will. Y'all get, first of all, do you get the argument? Do you understand what he's trying to say?
I think I'm coming up more with my counter arguments than I'm understanding what he's saying.
Okay, well, what is your counter argument?
Well, if I'm understanding the sense that he's saying something, on the basis, I thought it was lost in the first sentence. It says causality in accordance with the laws of nature. Causality shouldn't be subject to the laws of nature.
Okay, so that's one way to get around this. You could say, well, look, how do you know that all causality is subject to the laws of nature? Now, he might say to you, well, that would render all things random. Not necessarily. What if there is a transcendent cause that actually gives me my freedom, in which case I'm not subject to the laws of nature, but neither is there no explanation for the movement of my will? I have a God who actually is the cause of the fact of my free will. And therefore, my free will is not random. Here's another way to look at it. Last week, we actually gave an argument for the existence of the human soul, which is fundamentally immaterial, and therefore can quite possibly transcend the domino effect that exists all around us. In other words, the physical forces causing this, causing this, causing this. Well, my soul, because it's not trapped or subject to any and all physical causes, can break that domino effect. It can actually transcend it in a sense and move the will this way and that. So actually, as a theist, I have several ways of getting out of this argument so that both the thesis and the antithesis are both unsound if you look at freedom from a different vantage point or if you grant the existence of the soul. Now, I'm not going to do this to y'all because it would be more painful than what this is already doing to you. But Kant gives a series of parallelogisms, not antinomies, that actually question the existence of the soul. In fact, I reread that section today just to make sure I wasn't missing anything before I presented this to you. And one of the things that Kemp Smith says in his commentary is that what's really interesting is that when Kant leaves the topic, he ends up having to presuppose the soul and all the other things he does. The human psyche has had a very difficult time locating I, me, that to which your personal pronoun I or me refers to. And that, as I pointed out last week, is actually one really good reason to think that it's not something that's subject to empirical observation. It's something immaterial.
That's the example you use where the kid starts saying their name in the third person.
Right. They become fully aware of the soul that they are, would be one way of saying it. And so, given the fact that Kant himself, even after his efforts to remove from our categories of thought, the transcendental ego, or the I, the continuing I, will go on to presuppose it in his other essays and his other work, is an indication that his parallelogisms don't really work either. And so even on Kant's own standards, I am fully justified in invoking the existence of the soul to get out of this antinomy that he's given me. Does that make sense? And also, given the fact that he failed to give me a true antinomy in the preceding one, the second one, and his first one is really bad, I can already bring God into the equation to shore up the problems that exist when it comes to free will. One of the things that I didn't do last week is I didn't really get into the free will argument for theism, but you can actually argue from human freedom to the existence of God. One of the things that you'll notice is that no other philosophy out there that is naturalistic can account for human free will. Atheists themselves have landed in two basic schools of thought when it comes to human freedom. One school of thought will say that the human will is wholly random. And this is a view called anarchicism. It's the view that It is the view that Epicurus himself had. He believed that the soul acts randomly and that the soul itself was wholly material. Well, if the soul acts randomly, and if I find myself beating Lance here with a baseball bat one day, what am I going to say to him when I go into the hospital to see him? I'm sorry, Lance. I had an atomic swerve in my soul, and I just found myself beating you on the head with it. In other words, what Epicurus's view doesn't do is it doesn't account for human responsibility. Now, philosophers start with a given when they talk about human freedom. And the given is that humans are responsible moral agents. And why do they start off with that as a given? Because if you think about it, even if you set up a philosophy that would suggest that we're not responsible moral agents, human society is going to treat you like a responsible moral agent anyway. And our society has actually gone way out of its way to take away bad consequences for bad behavior. And yet what's really interesting is that they've actually replaced those bad consequences with other bad consequences.
Or rewards.
And so we continue to reward or praise people or punish or blame people for their behavior, even though our society has done a whole lot of, almost everything it can to remove the whole notion of moral responsibility from our discourse. Does that make sense? And so that's why we start off that with the given, and that's why anarchicism was never been taken seriously. Well, the other view that atheists have, the other view is the view called hard determinism, sometimes called environmental determinism, sometimes called mechanical determinism. And it's just the view that since I am not a soul, I'm just a physical body, I must be subject to the same laws of biology and physics that every other bit of matter is in this universe. Well, if that's true, then I'm just part of that domino, those dominoes falling. And therefore, any thought that I have that I am a free agent is just an illusion. And so we have Ricky Gervais having a conversation with Richard Dawkins. And what does he say? He says, well, I just don't think it's relevant whether I can prove I have free will or not. Why does Gervais say that? Well, because he knows that his atheism would suggest that you don't have free will. And Ricky Gervais says, regardless of whether I have it, I'm still going to treat you as if you're a morally responsible agent. Well, you know what he's really saying? If my net can't catch it, it ain't fish. My philosophy cannot take account of human free agency or human free will, and therefore I'm just going to get rid of it as a relevant question. But you know what? If you're going to go around treating people like they're responsible moral agents, you better give an account for how that's justifiable. And it can't be justified on atheism, because you are either going to be an anarchist or a hard determinist, and therefore you can't have free will. I, as a theist, on the other hand, can embrace the freedom of the will. I can wait, I can hold off the debate between the libertarians and the compatibilists. The compatibilists say that my human freedom is compatible with some forms of determinism. And the libertarian says my freedom is not compatible with some forms of determinism, and I am able to act in such a way that I'm wholly undetermined. Okay, let's hold off that debate. The point is that those are two viable views of human free will
that I as a theist can accept, but you as an atheist cannot. And therefore, I have another good reason to think that God exists, namely, I have free will. And once I embrace that, once I embrace all the things that I've just said, this third antinomy of Immanuel Kant just isn't sound. Which leads finally to the fourth antinomy, and here's where we're almost finished. I only have a few more things to say after that. There belongs to the world, this is on page 415, so I'll wait till you guys get to that. On page 415, there belongs to the world, either as its part or as its cause, a being that is absolutely necessary. An absolutely necessary being nowhere exists in the world, nor does it exist outside the world as its cause. Now, the first thesis is our worldview. There is a being who exists beyond the world as its cause that is absolutely necessary. Right? And we've also disproven the idea that an absolutely necessary being is a part of the world. That would be the pantheistic worldview. Y'all, so far so good? Okay, so what about the antithesis? He's obviously saying an absolutely necessary being nowhere exists in the world, nor does it exist outside the world as its cause. Well, let's look at that proof of that antithesis or antithesis. He says, if we assume that the world itself is necessary, or that a necessary being exists in it, there are then two alternatives. Either there is a beginning in the series of alterations, which is absolutely necessary and therefore without a cause, or the series itself is without any beginning, and although contingent and conditioned in all its parts, nonetheless, as a whole, is absolutely necessary and unconditioned. The former alternative, however, conflicts with the dynamical law of determination of all appearances in time, and the latter alternative contradicts itself, since the existence of a series cannot be necessary if no single member of it is necessary. Now, I want you to think about this for a second. Notice what Kant has said here. He says, to say that the world itself is that absolutely necessary being, that contradicts all appearances. This is on page 416, right-hand column at the top. He's saying the formal alternative conflicts with the dynamical law of determination of all appearances in time. To say that the world is the necessary being contradicts our experience. Because what do we experience in time? Change, conditionality, contingency, which the pantheist says you can't do. Or at least he says it's all an illusion. And then notice what he says. The latter alternative. What is the latter alternative? You could say that the world as a whole, together, all of these contingent things that exist, and when you add them up together, it turns the whole into a necessary being. Y'all see how that's an alternative? Look back on the previous page. He says, either there is a beginning in the series of alterations, which is absolutely necessary, and therefore without a cause, or the series itself is without any beginning, and although contingent and conditioned in its parts, nonetheless, as a whole, is absolutely necessary. Y'all following me? Right, so this is what some people want to do. They want to say, the world, even though it's contingent, is more than the sum of its parts. And so this is another pantheistic argument. So the pantheist is going to say that even though all the parts of the world are contingent, the whole is necessary. And therefore, the world is the uncaused cause. The world is God. But notice what Kant says here. He refutes that. He says that latter alternative, this idea that the world is a whole, the world, although its parts are contingent, the whole is necessary. He says the latter alternative, this alternative, contradicts itself, since the existence of a series cannot be necessary if no single member of it is necessary. Well, that was my Thomistic argument. My Thomistic argument said, if every member of the series is contingent, what is the whole series? It's contingent, and therefore needs a cause. And therefore he's, again, thank you, Mr. Kant. You just backed up yet another natural theological argument, namely the Thomistic argument. So thank you very much. Now, what does he say?
But it's still part of the phenomenon, right? So
oh, well, I'm about to refute this, but you have to understand, he's not proven any of this yet. His four antinomies were offered to prove it, and we're now at the fourth antinomy. So far, so good. He hasn't proven anything. Remember, what did you say? You said, how does he know that? This is how he thinks he knows that, and these are four bad arguments. So he doesn't know that.
So the antinomies are the four conclusions to how he knows
that? The antinomies are the four reasons why he knows that his critical philosophy is true. I quote Norman Kemp Smith, Immanuel Kant is one of the least consistent of the systematic philosophers. All right. Now, here's one more thing that we got to answer. Kant says this: if, on the other hand, we assume that an absolutely necessary cause of the world exists outside of the world, now this is what we believe, so he's going to attack what we believe directly, then the cause is the highest member in the series of causes of changes in the world, must begin the existence of the latter and their series. Now, this cause must itself begin to act, and its causality would therefore be in time, and so would belong to the sum of appearances, that is, to the world. What is he saying? It's impossible for an eternal cause to produce a temporal world. Why? Because an eternal cause must begin to act, but you can't begin to do something unless you exist in time. And therefore, there can be no such thing as an eternal cause existing outside of our contingent world. What do we say? Thomas Aquinas answered Kant long before he put pen in motion. Thomas Aquinas basically said this: God has eternally willed that a temporally finite universe exists. In other words, God never began to act in time to cause the world. He simply, from eternity, said, this world will be, and it will have these characteristics. So when did God start to create the universe? He never started to create the universe. He created it from eternity. Well, if he created it from eternity, then why isn't the world eternal? Because God didn't want it to be. He eternally willed that a temporally finite universe obtain. And so our universe has an absolute origin in time, and is actually the absolute origin of time, and all other events fall out in time in accordance with his decreed of will. That is the God that we've proven through natural theology. So far, so good. So, these four antinomies are either bad arguments or not antinomies at all, or actually help us in our natural theology. So the question is, what do we think about this phenomenal noumenal distinction? What do we think about this critical philosophy that Kant has created that actually embraces not only a distinction and a separation between the noumenal and phenomenal worlds, but also a dichotomy between faith and reason? This created all these problems that we actually have in the modern world, at least in terms of theology and us getting the word out. Well, I would say that not only is this not proven, the answer to your question has been given, Lance. How does he know that? This is how he knows it, the antinomies. But those are bad arguments, precisely. Therefore, he doesn't know it. You can't know what you don't prove by Kant's own standard. The categories of human thought have not established his antinomies. And therefore, we can say the antinomies don't give him this critical philosophy. But we can say more than that. I would suggest to all of you, both of you, that the critical philosophy of Immanuel Kant is fundamentally self-defeating. And here's what...
The critiques to Kant, is there anybody that's critiqued the critiques to reinforce what Kant was trying to say?
Well, one of the things that I don't know of anybody today that has given an elaborate and full defense of Immanuel Kant. I can name three or four philosophers that have destroyed him. And the three, the most important ones would be Norman Kemp Smith, who was, to my knowledge, was never a Christian. He was a expert in Kant's philosophy. Another person would be Reginald Garrigou Lagrange. the father of Thomistic philosophy, Roman Catholic philosopher, and then the evangelical philosopher Stuart Hackett, who in many respects is the father of the neoclassical renaissance of apologetics. He taught philosophy and theology at Trinity Divinity School in Illinois back in the 50s, and he wrote a book called The Resurrection of Theism, where he just knocks down the Kantian philosophy. And one of the things that Hackett and others have said is that this is a self-defeating philosophy precisely because Immanuel Kant notices, makes a distinction between the noumenal and the phenomenal. Now here's my question. How does he know that such a distinction exists? In order to know that there is such a thing as the noumenal world, what do you have to use?
Presuppositions.
The presuppositions or the categories of human thought. But those but you've also told me that the categories of human thought can't know anything about the noumenal world. Well, how can you know that the noumenal world is if you don't know a little about what the noumenal world is? You have to know a little bit about what the noumenal world is so as to draw a distinction between what is noumenal and what is phenomenal. So Kant is, in a nutshell, saying, I know you can't know, as Norman Geisler says. And you can't know that you can't know if you know something about what is there. To say that there's a distinction between the noumenal and phenomenal world, and yet I know absolutely nothing about this noumenal world, is the same thing as saying there's a distinction between my backyard and my neighbor's, but I know nothing about my neighbor's backyard. Surely I know a little bit about my neighbor's backyard. Even if he has really tall trees and I can't see through them, I know a little bit about what that backyard is about because I couldn't put my fence between us if I didn't know something about his backyard. Does that make sense? If I don't know anything about his backyard, then how can I even put up a fence to distinguish mine from his? Wouldn't I have to know a little bit about his backyard so as to make such a distinction between his and mine? I have to know the property line on this, and here's what I also have to know. I have to know that there are trees in his backyard. Why? Because they're blocking my view into his backyard. In order to know something, you don't have to know everything about that something that you know, right? All you have to know is something about what you know. So, do I know the moon exists? Do I?
You haven't been there, but you've seen it.
I've seen it, and I know a little bit about it, don't I? But do I know everything about it? No. I don't know what it's like to be on the moon. I don't know what it's like to run on the moon. I don't have that experience. But guess what I do? I know that the moon is real. So comprehension and knowledge are two different things. I can know something or apprehend something without comprehending it. And so when you go around saying there's a distinction between the noumenal and phenomenal, and yet I know nothing about the noumenal, I think you've defeated yourself. Here's another thing. What Kant is saying, really, is that the categories of the human mind are not laws of being, they're laws of thought. Think about that just for a minute. The law of contradiction is wholly a product of my mind. But it's not. There's nothing about the law of non-contradiction that is true of the world. In other words, the law does not really apply to reality in itself. Okay, so far so good? All the categories of the human mind are simply products of the human mind. None of them really apply to the real world, to the noumenal. They only apply at best to how things appear to me. But here's a question. First of all, how is it that you and I can both have the same law of logic? How can you and I both communicate with each other? If I can't know noumenal, yeah, but we both have to use the same law of logic in order to have that common language. So the point I'm making is, the very fact that you and I can speak with one another and communicate with one another and have this common language using the laws of logic would indicate that the laws of logic can be applied to things outside of myself. And so that the laws of logic are not merely laws of thought, that they are also laws of reality. The law of causality is true of the actual world. It's not merely just true of the way I should think about the world. Incidentally, have you noticed something? And here's one of the proofs that Gregor Lagrange gives us as to how this we know this is true. The law of causality is different than the law of non-contradiction, isn't it? The law of causality says that every event has to have a cause. When I'm looking at a ball rolling down the sidewalk, and I ask myself, what is explaining that? I'm utilizing the category of causality to explain this experience that I'm seeing, or the thing that I'm seeing. Does that make sense? I'm using the law of causality. Why can't I use the law of non-contradiction to explain why this is happening? If my mind is the product, is the thing that produces these laws, can't I just arbitrarily apply them to any phenomena I see? I can take the law of contradiction and apply it to balls rolling down a sidewalk, but I can't, can I? Because the explanation for why a ball rolls down a sidewalk is not a logical question, it's a causal one. And so the appropriate category to use to that phenomenon is, in fact, the law of causality, not the law of contradiction. And the very fact that I cannot arbitrarily apply these categories of thought would indicate that there's something outside of me that imposes these laws on me. And therefore, these are laws of reality, not merely laws of thought. I think I've spoken long enough. You guys are giving me a look like...
No.
Okay.
I'm trying to make sense of it in my head. So right. The causality part makes a lot of sense.
But the bottom line is...
I'm trying to think of what that argument looks or sounds like.
The bottom line is... I can't take the laws of logic, for example, and the law of causality and metaphysical intuitions like necessity and contingency. I can't mix them up and apply contingency to seemingly contradictory truths and make an assessment of them. I can't do that. And that means that there's something about reality that keeps me from being able to do that, because if it was wholly a product of my mind, I could apply them any way I want to. And so the non-arbitrariness of these categories would suggest that they are not a product of my will or my mind. They are simply, they are things that are imposed on me by reality itself. Now, one of the reasons why a lot of philosophers don't want to go there is because if you say that reality, that the laws of logic, for example, are laws of reality and not mere laws of thought, then you're saying that reality is itself fundamentally ordered. Which means that the reality you're talking about is either God himself or something caused by God. And so saying that the laws of thought are laws of reality or laws of being just is the claim that being is fundamentally ordered, and you're already off and running into a theistic proof. All right, I'm going to stop right there. Next week, we're going to look at whether our language about God is meaningful. That's going to be the first part. And the second part is we're going to look at the coherence of theism, whether our idea of God is rationally coherent. And then the following week, we're going to ask questions about the Bible, whether this view of God is biblical. And then we will finally, hopefully in 2 weeks, get into Hume's essay on miracles. So I'm probably going to give you some things to read as homework next week. So with that, let us end.